I'm Aaron Syme, host of the Scaling Tech Podcast, as always brought to you by agilityfeed.com, providers of technical staffing and software development services in Latin America for our clients globally. In today's live episode of the Scaling Tech Podcast, we're going to talk about what happens when your CI/CD pipeline becomes a bottleneck instead of a boost. How do internal tools empower or block engineering teams from shipping confidently? I'm here today with Tom Elliott, founder of OcuRoot and former engineering productivity lead at Yext, where he supported over 200 engineers through high-stakes deployment challenges. During nearly 20 years in the tech industry, Tom has worked for companies large and small on both sides of the pond and all layers of the tech stack. He brings sharp insight into the operational friction that slows engineering teams and how to design DevOps workflows that actually scale. Tom, welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast. Thanks for joining me today.
Great to join you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here with me today. And for those of you watching us live, you can ask a question anytime in the comments of whatever platform you're viewing this, and we'll address it. Tom, to start with, I want to ask about, you know, you've supported hundreds of engineers through major deployment pipelines. What are some of the early signs that a CI/CD process is about to collapse under its own weight?
It's a good question, because I think these are the sorts of things that like do sneak up on you pretty quickly. A lot of the time you won't realize that your pipelines aren't really going to scale until you have to scale them and it just doesn't work, and then you have to spend a ton of time working on it. I think that some of the key indicators from my experience have been where you've got a bunch of environments and they're all explicitly manually referenced in your configuration. If you are running off of templates that you haven't updated in a while, if your teams are frequently having to make, you know, like very, very bespoke changes. You know, example that I've seen that happen before was where we didn't really have good support for canaries. So teams sort of like rolled their own way of doing it. And then you had like three or four different ways of doing that. And it got a little bit confusing, because not only were they doing it in different ways, they also had a different process for executing it. So like dealing with the promotion wasn't consistent. So that, you know, that kind of makes me think that another indicator would probably be if onboarding spends a long time teaching people how to use their team's pipelines, you've probably got a consistency issue.
Yeah, that's a great point. Certainly I've heard about large tech companies that make a point of having like new software engineers push a change on their first day on the job, no matter how small or, you know, whatever the change is, just to get them all the way through that pipeline and to make sure that you can do that on that first day on the job. So if that concept blows your mind that we could push a change that fast with somebody new on the team, that would certainly be an indicator, right? That there's more that could be done in the pipeline. What would you say is the most common misunderstanding that engineering leaders have about the scalability of their DevOps tooling?
I think that a big misconception is that everyone needs the same kind of tools. If you've got a team that's of any size, you're going to have people with wildly different preferences, wildly different levels of experience, and a very different approach to the day-to-day. This manifested for me in that, like, anytime I was suggesting a new tool, you'd have suggesting a new feature or something like that for internal tools, you would have very, very senior members of the team complaining that it didn't do this very specific thing. That I'd have to go back to them and say, well, you are the only person that ever does this. You and one other, like, I am happy to create an escape hatch so that you can do this yourself. Like, I'm not gonna lock this down so you don't have access to the underlying thing that you as a very skilled person needs. Mm-hmm. But there's like 80% of the engineering team who just want something simple where they can do the same thing every day. That's who I'm catering for first.
Oh, that's a really interesting point. Can we drill down on that a little bit more and maybe give an example of a specific type of role or situation where you would say like an escape hatch is a good idea, and maybe versus something where that, you know, you're opening too many backdoors into the system, right?
Yeah, I mean the thing about backdoors and like the security angle of it, I think people can overplay that when you're talking about developers, because if mm-hmm. you know, if they have any kind of access to something, they're probably going to find a way to, you know, to make use of that access. So like, as long as they have the permissions, like, you know, limiting them in other ways is probably not that much use. As a kind of concrete example, we used Bazel a lot when I was at Yext, which is a build system originally put out by Google. And with that, you can create macros. So you just have a single function that can like chain together a bunch of builds, or like, you know, create a configuration with just a few parameters. And most people, you know, if they're going to be deploying an application, they just want to be able to build, test, and then deploy it to our typical environments. Mm-hmm. And you would have very senior people who would be like, oh, but I want to do this kind of test as well. Or, you know, maybe they want to do a load test in a more complex environment, or they want the ability to deploy to a completely different platform. You know, that will be a situation where it's like, not many people are going to do that, and they are definitely smart enough to figure that out. So I just have to say, like, okay, here is the underlying file that you're using. Like, go nuts with that. Like, you can use these primitives yourself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you don't need to over-engineer, you know, say that load testing environment, for instance, if there's only a limited number of people on the team who are going to use it, and you can kind of let the experts in that deal with that, right?
Yeah, yeah. Although if the only people who can use your load testing environment are the experts, that's probably a problem in and of itself.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So it's a double-edged sword.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. We were talking a little bit off air before this started, and you were telling me a little bit about your week. You have like multiple meetups you're at this week, and virtual conferences, and another podcast. So busy week, which is the life of a founder for sure. And so as the founder of AccuRoot, I'd love to hear a little bit more about that. You know, I know you've told me it was kind of born from a painful experience trying to spin up a GDPR compliant stack in the EU. I mean, tell us more about kind of that experience. Tell us more about AccuRoot, you know, and what made that project so hard that made you think we need a different solution for this?
Yeah, so the particular example that you're talking about was we wanted to have a European copy of our stack to satisfy data sovereignty, GDPR, as you mentioned. And we already had like a few points of presence for serving static content, but this was to have like, you know, all of our administration, all of our databases, everything like homed in the EU. And this was a huge and like very frustrating project for everyone involved, because like the original environment had grown up over, you know, 10 plus years. It was running in a data center. We were looking to move, put the stack in the cloud. And so like getting this up and running, it involved a whole bunch of different teams working together and waiting for each other. So like, mm-hmm. we had a separate infrastructure team who would initially prep the cloud accounts, then they would set up the networks, and then their internal database team would configure all the databases. And then they'd have to set up Nomad so that we could deploy to it. And so we'd be in a holding pattern for that. And there'd be a lot of unanswered questions along the way there. And then you had, you know, 30 different engineering teams who had to stand up their applications in there. And they all had questions about, well, can I stand up this before this? What happens? Because we'd never cold started before. There wasn't an experience where we actually accidentally cold started, but you know, that, and that proved a few things that we were able to do that we didn't think that we could. But there were all of these questions. And there wasn't a good way of us sort of exercising the plan without doing it and without standing up this environment. And then you had the CI/CD pipelines, which, you know, we had the rigid setup. We specifically specified all the environments. We had to rewrite all the pipelines to incorporate this. And we had questions about what happens if deploying to the US succeeds, but the EU fails. What do we do with the build in that instance?
Yeah.
So this made it a very long sequential project. And alongside that, the teams had a bunch of other work to do that was like significantly easier to justify. Because, you know, they'd have the product team saying, oh, well, we need these features so that we can do this big launch or for these customers. So this is, you know, like very much a secondary concern for a lot of teams, which is understandable, but that also made it difficult to schedule, especially when, you know, one team is waiting for another one. So I started thinking about what it would look like to be able to automate that whole process, and where the challenges were in building full automation for standing in large environments. And what I'm looking to achieve with OcuRoute is the ability to chain together your existing deployment automations and build relationships between them so that if you want to do something big, it can figure out the right order automatically for you. So you know, if you're using Terraform or Helm, those have inputs and outputs. So you can kind of glue those together. So like the output from service A becomes an input to service B, but you can deploy them independently. So over time, you can build up a map of your entire environment and all of your different environments from this set of rules. See how everything fits together, and when you're ready, you hit a button and it just automatically builds everything from, you know, an empty cloud account.
Fantastic. So you build up like this giant dependency map of everything in there, and based on that, OcuRoute knows how to do the deployment to it and kind of in what order to handle that deployment, and I suppose a rollback as well if you decided that you needed to roll back something.
Oh yeah, rollbacks are like a really interesting problem, because we ended up with like three or four different ways of doing rollbacks, because each different downstream platform had their own way of doing it. So, you know, you do rollbacks one way in Nomad, you do rollbacks one way in Kubernetes. Terraform, you're probably looking to redeploy something or revert a change. And you could also redeploy or revert a change to these other things that had their own platform. So when someone needed to do a rollback, they had to think like, okay, well, what's the best way to do this rollback, which takes time when you're in an emergency situation.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. What kind of teams or deployments is it sort of optimized for as sort of your ideal user of OcuRoute?
So I've been looking mostly at kind of mid-sized engineering orgs, primarily within B2B companies. These are the kind of organizations that are most likely to, A, have multiple environments. You know, maybe you're doing single tenancy, maybe you're doing region-based stuff. Mm-hmm. And as an engineering teams grow, you are more likely to want to evolve your DevOps or even your platform engineering prowess, shall we say. So this is where I think OcuRoute is able to solve the problems that kind of emerge as you go through that growth that these kinds of companies experience. It's not to say there's not benefit to, like, you know, B2C companies, but a lot of them, you know, I was speaking to someone at a large B2C company who I'm not sure if I'm able to name them, but they literally just have two environments. And they do full blue-green deployments between those two environments and just flip between them, whichever one's the main production one.
Oh, wow.
Which like is bewildering to me that they can pull this off, because they've got so many services running in these environments.
Yeah, really.
I'd love to sit down for like, you know, a day and just pick the brains of these people to figure out how they make that work.
Yeah, for sure. Well, after you do that, we'll have to talk again. I'd be curious to hear more about how that works too.
Absolutely.
So if I understood right, kind of the story of the painful product that project that you had that inspired Akiru, you talked about it being like 10 years of legacy code, I think, and sort of accidentally doing a cold start installation of it. Was the complexity based on it kind of, you know, over 10 years, you know, you're continually adding little bits, but never, rarely anyways, doing kind of a fresh deploy, a fresh start, mm-hmm. you know, that cold start, as you said. Would you recommend for someone with kind of a legacy system that they force themselves to go through that process as, you know, maybe even before using AccuRoot or, you know, just as a learning exercise?
So it's interesting because like a 10-year system that starts today is going to be very different from a 10-year-old system that started 10 years ago.
Right.
I mean, even now, like we're a few years out from this project that I was talking about. And mm-hmm. you know, someone who's got that same level of legacy now, things are gonna be different because technology is moving along so fast. Like when we started, you know, Kubernetes didn't exist. The CI landscape was kind of limited. There wasn't really much in the way of CD tooling at all. This is going back to like when Jenkins was the primary CI provider and it was kind of the only game in town. And then, you know, you had a whole bunch of other solutions that have come up since then. In terms of a recommendation for an organization dealing with legacy, I think that some of the things to look out for are the manual things that have been set up. So like, you know, if people have like manually configured a server, authorization settings like RBAC and all that kind of thing. Those are the things that are going to be hard to reproduce, but it's also the things that it's totally okay to do manually early on.
Yeah.
I recently wrote an article about like how there's things that people say are the best practices, mm-hmm. You know, like automating everything, like doing full end-to-end CI/CD. But when you've got a small project and you're just starting out, like that is not the best practice because it's just going to slow you down for minimal benefit.
Right.
And it's only like a few years down the line that you're going to really see these things.
Yeah.
So I think you've got to be vigilant and always thinking about what's coming next and how you need to prepare for it, which is a really difficult thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you were saying, you know, a moment ago about how, you know, a 10-year-old system a few years ago is very different than a system designed today, what it will be like in 10 years. And the thought that immediately popped into my mind was, is there anything that we're building now that will still exist in 10 years, right? Because things seem to be changing so rapidly. It's hard to imagine that, you know, any sort of technology architecture that we pick now would still exist in 10 years. And that's it. But I caught myself before saying that because the reality is we have lots of legacy systems out there now that are, you know, more than 10 years old. And, you know, there's still systems out there using COBOL and Pascal that, you know, maybe people don't always want to admit to, but they exist. They're still being used in major industries like fintech, for example, you know. So we tend to have, you know, it's a challenge because things are changing rapidly. How we will do DevOps will change rapidly. And so we have I don't know the right term for it, but there's like a bias that we have that they will change more rapidly than we believe they will change more rapidly than they really do. Right. Mm-hmm. And in some sectors, they will change really rapid. If you're a startup right now and you're able to take advantage of the latest and greatest things in the next year, then, you know, your architecture is going to look very different than, you know, a company with more legacy systems. It's going to take more time to adapt to these changes, right? So that balance that you're talking about is going to be really only increasingly hard to strike, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I mean, I think the example of the older systems that have survived for such a long time, you know, this is kind of a survivorship bias thing, because like, you know, these things are still around because they work, and they work
right.
really well. And you know, there's definitely a tendency for engineers to want to replace older things. Like people yeah. feel like technology is going to rot if it's sitting there for a long time. But you know, if you're keeping up on security patches and all that kind of thing, probably okay to not change things over a long period of time. I've spoken to people who sort of consider legacy to be anything that's more than a few years old, but then like there were way more nuanced ways of thinking about it. And
sure.
I think that if you are finding it difficult to make changes going forward and sort of actually evolve as you need to make the business work, yeah. that's when you've got a real legacy system. It's like it's difficult to keep up with what you need to do.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's like discussions we've had on the Scaling Tech podcast too with other guests too about like technical debt and how do you decide if something is technical debt or, you know, and arguably everything is legacy, everything is technical debt right after you do it. It's just a matter of how, you know, at what point does it become something that hinders your progress? You know, like you said, if it's making it hard for you to add in new functionality that you need in order to stay competitive, to deliver value to your customers, then that's, you know, call it tech debt, call it a legacy problem, whatever, you know, that's the issue. That's when you definitely have to address it. Or yeah. if you're unable to make those security patches, you know, for some legacy reason, and then, you know, the security of the system is decaying over time. That's another, you know, good example of where, yeah, you have to bite the bullet and really do a larger re-architecture of it. I want to talk a little bit about like deployment visibility and tracking. I know you've written about tracking deployments by commit rather than just configuration in order to better scale. So first, for, you know, anyone not familiar, kind of explain the difference between those two methods and some pros and cons. And then, you know, I'd like to hear kind of how does this change, this sort of visibility change the way that teams handle incidents or rollbacks?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's kind of like two main ways I've seen of doing this. And a lot of it comes down to the structure of the team and who's responsible for what. So there's a lot of organizations that will do sort of like end-to-end CI. So whenever you commit something, it will do the build, it will store the artifacts, and then it will immediately run deploys in all the relevant places. You know, maybe there's some human gates and promotion, but maybe there's, you know, just do some tests and push it out as soon as those pass. That's great. Then you have a straight line between the code that you committed and what's running in production, and it's down to your tool to be able to make it easy to find out what's and where. More recently, with tools like Argo and other pure CD tools, you have more of a pull model. So each of your environments are looking for changes in, you know, like a GitOps repo where you're saying, I would like it to look like this. And then you're sort of creating a separation between the build and the deployment, right? It's like you do this build, you run all your tests, and then you call that a version that you can pull in through your GitOps process. That can be frustrating if the same people doing the builds are the ones who are responsible for doing the deployments, but talk to some organizations where you have the separation between those teams, and that becomes and that becomes a sensible way of doing things because the responsibilities are so different. What I'd like to see is kind of both at the same time. So you can like, you have this model where you have your versions very tightly tied and related to the build, the commits and the changes that you made. But you also have the ability to have more fine-grained control and more complex rules about when and how they get into those different environments. So you can follow all of your compliance rules. You can, you know, have different teams responsible for different things and like responsible for figuring out what needs to run where. But at the same time, you can immediately say, okay, this thing running in here includes these changes. So if it breaks, we can guess it's something between this commit and this commit that caused the problem. Mm-hmm. And then you get into the situation of doing audits if you're a big enough company, where an auditor will come to you with a list of commits and say, when were these deployed to which environments, which we had to solve by getting a very expensive engineer to spend a day taking screenshots. I want to make that a bit easier.
Wow. A very expensive engineer taking screenshots, you said, was how you handled that audit process. That does sound painful. Can you share a little bit more about kind of some recommendations around handling audit processes? You know, what you would do now, what maybe AccuRoute does that to make that process easier?
Yeah, I mean, as a high level recommendation, I think that like pragmatism is really important when you're dealing with compliance and security as well. Like there's a perception that there's kind of an adversarial relationship between engineering and compliance and security. But like the best professionals in both of those fields are not the people saying no all the time. It's the ones who are like trying to figure out, okay, well, you want to do this, but we have this control. So how do we meet in the middle and massage both the wording of the control along with the process that we're putting in place so that we can have something that's going to satisfy an external party? So, you know, we had things where we evolved the user checks that we had to do every 6 months. We'd have to go through an entire list of all of our users and make sure that they were provisioned correctly and that people who've been offboarded have been taken out of all of these systems. That I got to see that process evolve from one where you would have to like go line by line through every user and check a box. And you know, be like, okay, this person's still here, this person's still here, this person's still here. And you'd have to like prove where you got that data from and things, to being a few scripts where you basically just had to do a screen recording of you running this script against the CSV that you pulled down, and then it would just give you a list of anyone that didn't match up. Okay. And the being able to see that process run was plenty evidence for the external auditor to say that we'd done that verification effectively. And that saved a huge amount of time. So something I want to provide with AccuRoute is, you know, that I've got this huge amount of state available, like this full history in AccuRoute state store of everything that has happened. And I can maintain that so that you can say, okay, I want the history for these commits, or, you know, I want history for this particular package in these environments. And it can produce a report that has everything that has happened, because you have to record that data to know what's running where anyway. So why not make it more useful?
Excellent. Oh, thank you. That's really helpful. So let's talk about something else. I know you have a little bit of a love-hate relationship with feature flags. We have some strong feelings around that. You've talked about situations before where they become more of a liability than a help to a team. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of goes back to my thoughts around like best practices in general. It's like there's a time when it's appropriate to adopt something. And I think a lot of people rush to doing feature flags because they think it's the right way to do things. But there are very specific goals that feature flags can help you achieve, like being able to control the release of a big feature, or being able to keep certain, you know, picky customers happy. Like banks are notorious for this. Like we had the financial institution as a customer that insisted that we kept the same UI style over a period of many years because they didn't want to have to change their training materials for thousands of people. It's like, you know, fair enough, you know. But where I think feature flags can be a hindrance is if you overuse them, you've got a lot of logic in your application that is purely branching around feature flags. Mm-hmm. And you have to keep track of all of these feature flags.
Yeah.
And then you inevitably get, and as we were talking about people wanting to get rid of tech debt and get rid of legacy, you'll get the person who's like, we need to clean up these feature flags. So then you have another big project,
right,
to clean up the old feature flags. And that can cause you know, a huge amount of slowdown. It can confuse people when they're trying to get used to the code base. Mm-hmm. I don't think that feature flags are a bad thing, but I think you have to be very careful about how you apply them, and you need to have a plan and a sort of a policy around how they should be used and when it's appropriate to use them.
Yeah. Yeah. What sort of policy would you recommend there in terms of, you know, after it's been in the system this amount of time, you've got to take out the flag logic, or kind of, you know, what sorts of things do you enforce to minimize that tech debt from sticking around?
So, I mean, I think, like, ideally, don't put it in the first place. Like, you know, if you've put enough thought into like the longevity and the meaning of a feature flag, so that you don't have to remove it in the future, that's great. Yeah. There's also thinking about like the purpose of any particular flag and sort of what its life cycle is going to look like ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So you could have, like, say, if you have a broad feature that is incompatible with another feature and you need to isolate those two, then that feature flag is effectively going to live forever. If you have a backwards incompatible change that affects your UI, then you're probably going to have to keep that flag around as long as there are people still using the old version. And getting people to upgrade, not easy when they're paying you money. unless you can offer them something really good for upgrading.
Unless you can offer to rewrite that bank's user manual for them, so they'll let you change the color, right?
yeah, exactly. And there's also like plenty of other ways of achieving the same sort of goals. So if you like have an API or like an SDK, which I'm building at the moment, there are other ways of versioning that don't involve feature flags. And then the impetus is a lot more on the end user, and you can provide them with a consistent experience through that sort of a mechanism. I think the biggest pitfall that I've seen with feature flags is adding a new feature flag for each quarter's work, or like say, oh, we're going to do, you know, we're going to put this new release out, and we're going to gate all the features behind it. And so these accumulate over time, and that forces you to do a cleanup operation, because that really creates a very short lifetime for these flags. Mm-hmm. And the other issue that I've seen happen with doing it like that is that it's not really clear if something is behind that flag or not, because that, you know, flag that says like, you know, Q3 2025 is not descriptive about what it does or should contain.
Right. Exactly. And kind of implies that it's an all or nothing, that release, which is problematic too, right? Like, part of the benefit or the idea of why you would want to do a feature flag is to, you know, allow for some sort of gradual rollout, right, of smaller features one by one and that sort of thing. So.
There are like, alongside the API thing and the SDK thing, there is also like really interesting things you can do with routing if you're doing microservices as well. So like keeping a few old versions of a microservice running sometimes can give you that same sort of benefit.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So let's talk about kind of internally developed platforms and kind of productivity in the engineering team as a whole. You know, I think you've talked about some internal platforms kind of building things yourself, so to speak, as actually slowing teams down. What separates a good internal platform from one that, you know, becomes a bottleneck over time?
I have a somewhat strong opinion about the idea of community-led efforts. So when I was at Yext, we toyed around with the idea of having sort of like the official internal tools that, like, we changed our group name several times, so I'm not sure which one to use. But the team responsible for DevOps, like, are responsible for maintaining. And that they officially support and that they are on the hook for. Then we had community tools, which was just like, maybe it came out of a hackathon or someone had an idea for something they wanted to have. And because there was no official ownership of that, those things sort of atrophied and they didn't get improvements. And like, you know, you'd end up with a couple of competing tools and that could become a problem. That's not to say that you should never have community supported tools internally or sort of like hobby tools. But when you have a dedicated team and you also have community stuff, that can create a lot of confusion and people not understanding who is actually responsible for what. Other things that like can be challenges around internal platforms, I think when you, I think I mentioned consistency a while back, like if you have multiple ways of doing the same thing and it's not obvious why you would choose any one of those, that can cause a lot of slowdown, that can cause a lot of cognitive load. And there was a mistake that I was definitely guilty of in not realizing who the audience was, or what the scope of the team's responsibility would be. So I spent a lot of time focusing on the product engineering teams who were developing a very particular way. They had, you know, clear concepts of dev, staging, production environments. They were, you know, doing microservices practices. You would have like one version running in any environment at any given time, those kinds of rules. That was fine for them. Less meaningful for the infrastructure team, who were also using some of the tools around the edges for their own purposes. And then it was completely useless for anyone in the data science team who like thought about things in a completely different way. And I never really nailed down where the responsibility that I had ended. Right. So I was like kind of trying to support these other teams, and sometimes they think I was responsible for supporting them, but I don't think it was really clear to anyone whether I should have been. which, you know, it made it difficult to plan effectively, and you know, we ended up creating some concepts that really only served one area of the organization, and kind of left others behind.
Interesting. Something else you've talked about before is using a past decision that sort of cast long shadows, had longer term implications of, you know, in some previous work earlier in your career, making the choice to like self-host Get and use Nomad instead of Kubernetes, and kind of made some challenges for the team later on in adopting new tools. Tell us a little bit about that experience and kind of what sort of advice do you offer to teams based on that when making infrastructure decisions? And
Yeah, those examples you called out, I think like certainly the self-hosting Git thing, that is definitely an example of like the 10-year-old system now being very different from the 10-year-old system in 10 years' time. Because you know, the reason that we were originally self-hosting Git, as I understand it, is that at the time GitHub wasn't really up to what we wanted for an enterprise offering. You know, it just made sense at the time to self-host. Since then, all of the interesting tools are like GitHub first. And then, so it's like, you know, GitHub first, then probably GitLab, maybe Bitbucket if you're lucky, but like if you're self-hosting Git, you're on your own. Right. And that created a lot of missed opportunities, I think, like places where we could potentially have had really interesting tools and interesting workflows, but because we were primarily on this self-hosted Git, we just couldn't adopt those. And similarly with Nomad, like we adopted Nomad because it was closer to what we'd previously been using and the migration was easier. It was like a much less of a leap than going to Kubernetes, which we tried and didn't have a lot of success with. But what we were missing from Kubernetes is that there's this huge community and all of these things that you can deploy with a simple Helm chart or just, you know, a single command, and it's all set up to do that. So what we ended up doing was actually having a completely separate Kubernetes cluster just to run tools. So we were running all kinds of like third party open source tools in this Kubernetes cluster because it was just easier to deploy those there.
Right. Yeah. Well, like you said, it's an example of it's too specific an example because it was, you know, based on decisions in a whole different context, you know, in the past. Is there, do you have any sort of like advice or rubrics on kind of how you think about those trade-offs now for things that, you know, make sense given current context and current architectural patterns and technologies, but trying to leave in some flexibility for the future, you know, for the unanticipated.
I am setting myself up for one right now, to be completely honest with you.
Okay.
I'm a Go programmer primarily. Uh-huh. I love the language. I've been working with it for nearly 10 years now. And there's a lot about it that just works for me, given my temperament and my preferences. I know it's not for everyone. But I'm doing as much as I possibly can in Go right now because I can move more quickly that way. And I've started using what's described as the Goth stack, which is like Go, a tool called Temple, which is kind of like JSX for Go, and HTMX, which is kind of like sort of like Ajax calls made easy with data tags in HTML. Mm-hmm. That does limit some things I can use because, you know, a lot of tools now assume React. There's a lot of really neat little widgets you can put in if you're using React. And most front-end people that I might hire in the future probably going to know some JavaScript framework first.
Right.
The odds of finding a front-end Go programmer are basically zero, I think. but you know, this is a trade-off that I'm making now with the understanding that like this, there is going to be some sort of pain coming out of this, but it allows me to be much more quick-moving and much more consistent about how I go about things. I might end up writing some interesting tools like an open source as a result of this as well. But the way that I'm mitigating against that is thinking about like, okay, well, if I want to introduce some React components, how am I going to do that? And I've played around with that a bit. I've got a path forward there, which I actually like quite a lot. This sort of like the, I think someone described it as like the interactivity island concept, where rather than having a full SPA, you've got segments of your site that are running as standalone React components. So like just, you know, like one corner of one page is enabled in that way. So that's something I'm keeping an eye of, and I'm very aware of the trade-off I'm making right now.
Excellent. So we're nearing the end of our time here. I have one more question I want to ask you more from kind of like a management perspective. In DevOps in general, there's a tension between being seen, whether you're seen as like a cost center in the organization versus delivering customer facing value that, you know, a product team can maybe easily justify. DevOps sometimes struggles with that. And so how do you manage that tension? How do you talk about DevOps in the organization that, you know, prevents it from the negatives of being seen only as a cost center?
I think it's really important to maintain a good relationship with your customers. And those customers are the product-facing engineers, the people who are building the stuff that's generating the revenue. If they feel like your presence is a benefit rather than a hindrance, they're going to go to bat for you. And if you can point to any evidence that basically says that our being here is making everyone else more productive and more effective, then that's going to kind of help smooth that broken line to revenue. So, you know, things like I resisted doing surveys for so long, but it's honestly a really easy way to do a check-in and just be like, hey, general satisfaction survey, how happy are you with your tool, scale of 1 to 5, and then you've got some numbers that you can show. Don't try to measure like the amount of code people are putting out within, you know, things like numbers of daily deploys is a very nice vanity metric, but it does not necessarily indicate that you're doing the right things.
if
the engineers generally feel like they are more productive, that's probably going to be enough to satisfy the execs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Tom, for all of the expertise you've shared with us today. Are there any other closing thoughts that you want to share with our listeners? And how can they learn more about your work and AccuRoot and get in touch with you?
Sure. I guess, you know, as a summarizing closing thought, I would urge people to be aware of the trade-offs that you're making today. But don't let that awareness stop you from making those trade-offs. Like, don't overfit for 5-10 years from now.
Right.
You can change if you do things well early on. In terms of getting in touch with me, there's my company site, AccuRoot.com. There's also I've got a personal site, telliot.me, 2 L's and 2 T's. I post pretty regularly on LinkedIn and Blue Sky. And there's links to both of those from my personal site. Always looking to build new connections. So if anyone wants to reach out and say hi on LinkedIn, I'd be more than happy to chat.
Fantastic. Thank you, Tom. I'm definitely looking forward to staying in touch with you myself on LinkedIn. And so I certainly encourage our listeners to go give you a follow there too, as well as to check out AccuRoot.com. Thanks again for joining me today, Tom. Appreciate it.
No, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. For our viewers, if your team could use some help finding top-tier software development and technical talent in Latin America, then check out the technical staffing services of our sponsor, AgilityFeet, at agilityfeet.com. This conversation will be archived on the Scaling Tech Podcast YouTube channel. And to learn more about other episodes of the Scaling Tech Podcast, be sure to follow us on YouTube and the podcast platform of your choice, as well as visiting scalingtechpod.com. Thanks for joining us for this live episode of the Scaling Tech Podcast.